Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the celebrated composer and educator, Daniel Strong Godfrey. Please join us as we discuss the new album, Toward Light, by the Cassatt String Quartet and various special guests performing three of his quintets, his involvement in the Seal Bay Festival of American Chamber Music, and much more. Before we begin, please hit the like, follow, and subscribe buttons, and all the other buttons that you happen to see down there. It's an easy thing to do, and it really does help the channel a lot. Also, leave a comment. Let me know what you think. Your opinion is very important to me. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the program the award-winning American composer, Daniel Strong Godfrey. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I really, really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
So, I've just have really been enjoying listening to your music in preparation for this conversation, and there's just so much that I want to talk about. But you've got a I couldn't listen to everything. You've got a big catalog. You've been a busy man in your lifetime.
I keep at it, and I added to it as, you know, being in academia and being in administration. I'm gratefully retired at this point, so I hope to be busier than I was as far as being a composer. So
yeah, doing this program for me is only possible because I'm kind of retired from everything else that I was doing. So now I have free time, and if I don't use it wisely, my wife will smother me in my sleep. So so anyway, I think before we get too deep here and some of the other things. You and I were talking off camera a moment ago about your style and your aesthetic. Could we kind of get into that a little bit? We'll just touch on that a little bit. Not a lot. I mean, the music that I'm hearing is very listenable. I think if somebody, some contemporary music can be a little jarring to the untrained ear. But yours doesn't seem to be. Yours is very easy to listen to.
Well, even though some of my contemporaries would frown, I take that as a compliment. I write in a style that touches on all the music that naturally is an organic reflection of all the music that I've loved since I was born. Uh-huh. But also reflects the fact that I was educated and I've come of age now age 75, in a world that emphasizes newness and sort of contemporary practice. And all of that is in the blender that comes out somehow through, you know, the personality of how I write.
I know that somebody, there was I'm a guitar guy. There's a classical guitarist named John Dewart, English guy. He's passed away a few years ago now. Wrote a lot of stuff. And somebody once asked him how he was hoping that he would be remembered in posterity, you know, how people would remember him. And he said, I could care less about posterity. He said, I just want people to play my music. and his music, again, is very listenable. It's very easy. He was trained in jazz, and he kind of moved over to classical. But his thought was, I just want to write music for people to enjoy and to express myself. And I always thought that was a great philosophy.
Well, I have, you know, been compared to so many composers that in some cases are really the opposite from one another, that it's clearly a challenge for reviewers to label my music. And I would rather it just not be labeled, and I would just like people to listen to the music. And it's interesting that you talk about this in the context of a performer, because one of my mentors, you know, challenged me to say, why do you write music? Do you write it for yourself? Do you write it for your audience? And she said the only meaningful, in her mind, the only meaningful way to write is to write for the performer. Because if you can connect with the performer, everything else takes care of itself. And so that's one of the things that I think is important about this album of mine that just came out, is that I've been working with the Cassatt String Quartet literally for decades. And I've learned to write for them, and they've learned to respond to how I write. And I feel like I've always felt that quartet, especially the first violinist, Muneeko Ohtani, really understands where I'm going and what I'm trying to share with listeners and performers. And so I've been very lucky that way.
Jennifer Leschnauer and Emily Brandenburg from that quartet have both been guests on the show. I love the Cassatt Quartet. I think they're amazing, and they have a not only great players, which you would expect, but also a great aesthetic. I really like their choices of music and the way they present it. So,
100%.
Now your new album, Toward Light. Now it's a series of three quintets, right?
Right.
And the first quintet, I'm going to mispronounce this, but it's Ricordanza Speranza.
You got it.
Well, that'll be the first thing I got right today. But I'll try not to get used to it. Ursula Oppens on piano along with the Cassatt Quartet. And that's wonderful. To Mourn, To Dance, with Nicole Johnson on cello. And I was just listening to a couple of movements, including the fugue / Tarantella, the final movement of that, which I really liked a lot. The Tarantella is a lot of fun. And then Toward Light, the title piece, Elliot Fisk, who I don't know the man, but I have admired his playing for several decades now. He's an amazing player.
Yeah.
And listening, and that's the first one that I listened to was gravitate, you know, letting my own prejudices dictate, but I loved it. I was able to listen to all four movements and just really reveled in that. Now, did you intend to write for guitar initially, or were you just kind of picking instruments out of a hat, or how did that work?
Well, when I was chair of music in Northeastern, I interacted with with faculty and administration at the New England Conservatory on several occasions on a variety of for a variety of purposes, because it's literally the New England Conservatory is a 10-minute walk from my office at Northeastern University, and I got involved with Elliot Fisk's Guitar Fest because we helped to co-sponsor it through the years when it was still being funded at the university level. And so I got to know Elliot very well, and he got to know my music. And we kind of arrived at the idea of a guitar quintet, guitar plus string quartet, kind of in the same conversation. I mean, we over the first 5 years that we knew each other and he got to know my music, it was clear that we wanted to work together in collaboration. And he's an amazing player and a very free soul. And so collaborating him with was a unique experience. I mean, he got me thinking about, I had never really written for guitar up until that moment. And so he's the one who educated me on what I could do, what I couldn't do.
It's a challenge if you don't play the instrument.
Absolutely. And I had to study it a lot to get where we got with it. And the cadenza in particular, I mean, mainly I got my way, but he introduced textures and flourishes that I would not have known about no matter how hard I studied. And a lot of them are just unique to his technique. Although I think any guitarist at his level could take them up. But it was a true collaboration and a wonderful experience that way.
I am a big fan of chamber music. I have been for almost my entire life. It's kind of my preferred form, and I enjoy playing it more than I enjoy playing solo, and I enjoy listening to it. I love everything. I'm sure everybody does, but that has kind of a special spot for me. One of my complaints with guitar is it is very rarely included, and should be, but it's very rarely included in the chamber setting other than as an accompaniment instrument or in multiple guitars, guitar duo, guitar trio, something like that. And you were able to just Absolutely nail it. I mean, boy, you pushed all my buttons with that one. And because the guitar really is an equal member of the ensemble. It's not better than, it's not worse than, it's not above or below. It is on equal footing with every other member of that group. And the music fits so well. It's just very well written. And that's a rare thing. I don't hear that very
Well, I had a great tutor in Elliott,
often.
and I think one of the things that speaks to that is that at the premiere, which was in Jordan Hall at the New England Conservatory, there was no amplification, there was no unique approach to recording. It all came out very well balanced, just because I think we really arrived at a place where we really understood how the ensemble and the soloist interacted. And the soloists in a lot of ways were just as important and had just as important things to convey as the soloist did. So they were really all on an equal footing. But he plays with so much personality that was the factor that I really had to take into account. I mean, I had to have the soloist and the ensemble work together in a balanced way, but in a way that didn't repress the unique qualities of his playing. And it was a wonderfully educational experience to have to meet that challenge.
I saw a video years ago. And I think it was gosh, it was Heifetz and Rubinstein and somebody else. And they were playing chamber music in a piano trio. And one of the things that they said was the most difficult part for them was they all had such strong personalities. And so to say, and that trying to blend as a true trio was a real challenge. They were, because they're so used to just dominating any space that they were in, each one of them. So, and I see that with a player like Fisk, it would be easy for somebody like that to just to suck all the air out of the room. And it just didn't happen at all. I mean, he was
Well,
wonderful.
he's a great chamber player too. I mean, in this organization that he runs called the Boston Guitar Fest, there's a lot of interaction with other instrumentation. There's a lot of guitar trios, quartets. I mean, I think one of the first Guitar Fest performances I heard was with 16 guitars. And they were all terrific players. Some of them were the best students, and some of them were guest faculty, and it just worked wonderfully well. And I think he understands chamber music. It's I think a reflection of the inst of his colleagues as well, the people that he works with on the faculty there. I mean, it's a very different kind of a challenge. Most of my repertoire is chamber music. I happen to be writing a piano concerto at the moment, which offers a completely different set of challenges, and there's a lot of there's a lot of hope and prayer that it all works out, because you're never really sure until you hear the ensemble and the soloist play together. But chamber music has been a favorite idiom of mine, and a lot of that is attributable to how wonderful it has been to work with a Cassatt string quartet. It's very it's hard to turn them down when they invite, me to consider the next project.
They're wonderful. I just really enjoyed and enjoy listening to them. It's interesting because when I prepare for an interview, obviously I want to listen to the music. I want to see what this is all about, and I read the bios and do the things that just due diligence. But in their case, and it happens in other cases, it will in yours as well. I find myself, my little cookie at the end of the day is I sit in front of YouTube and I listen to music for about an hour before I go to bed at night, because I don't get a chance to just listen for fun during the day usually. And so that's my time. I just kind of chill for a while. And I always find myself going back to certain people, like the Cassatts, and certainly Toward Light will be on that. Well, just sitting here and just want to hear something nice in the evening, and I listen to it not for research. I'll listen to it, and not because I have to, but because I just want it. It's good music, and I enjoy it.
Oh, thank you.
So anyway, a couple of other things I wanted to talk about real quick. Like you were talking about chamber music a lot. You also were a founder of the Seal Bay Chamber Music, American Chamber Music Festival.
Yeah, we started up. I think our first festival was in the summer of 1995, and we've had to miss a few years because schedules didn't always coalesce, and then of course there was COVID.
Sure.
But this last summer we had our 22nd season, and the organization's been in existence for 30 years, and it's a different kind of a festival in the sense that the whole concept is built around the relationship between a kind of three-way relationship between the composer, the performer, and the audience. And I view them all as equally significant. And it requires a kind of personal connection between the performer and the performers and the composer. And the way we start that off is we begin rehearsing and collaborating on the island of Vinalhaven, out on a remote corner of the island, which is extraordinarily beautiful and quiet and serene, on a body of water called Seal Bay, not surprisingly, and hence the Seal Bay Festival. And it's a lot of rehearsing, a lot of rigorous interaction in terms of the performers working with a composer to get everything just right, with recreational times in between. I kind of become a camp counselor, and I take people out on the water to look at the seals and to look at the more remote parts. I mean, the whole bay is protected by conservation easement, so it's all quite remote. But then people like to go into the town, which is about a 15-minute drive away at the south end of the island, which is village life. And it's a fishing village, it's a lobster community, and so it's kind of a way of getting everybody into a certain psychological space. And then what we do is we perform on the island. We do a formal concert. We record our student fellows' music. We perform their music. We do a benefit concert for the school, and then we take it to the mainland and take the show on the road. And we start up in Belfast usually, and do a concert there, and then work our way down the coast and usually do a final concert in Portland at the Conservatory of Music, which is a community music school. But the Cassatt also does this wonderful thing where they do outreach concerts at retirement homes and children's museums and libraries and so on. And there are usually about 10 of those outreach concerts, which are of course free and open to all the listeners. And so it's but they're performed with the same rigor and the same commitment to making new music a personal and human experience, as the more formal concerts are. And so the whole idea is to put a human face on what composers are doing today. And you have this remarkable experience of a lot of repertoires. Some of our repertoire is really quite challenging. I mean, it's contemporary repertoire. There's a lot of aleatory, a lot of dissonance, a lot of experimentation, but the audience is just as engaged with that music as they are with stuff that you and I might call more listenable. It's all part of one kind of mosaic of aesthetics that we present in these concerts, and because it's so personal and because it's performed with such urgency and immediacy, people respond to all of the music, not just to the more quote unquote conservative repertoire. So it's really a way of connecting people to what's going on in the world of so-called classical music right now and today, so that it has a more immediate relevance for them.
Now, do you find finding an audience challenging at all, or are you okay with that department?
We used to find it challenging when we did it earlier in the year. We used to hold the festival in the early part of June, and we did that in part so that we could overlap with school programs. But we found that we can get young people involved in a whole variety of ways, even when doing the concerts in late July and early August. And at that point, there is absolutely no problem finding an audience. I mean, we've had full houses in Belfast and in Portland, and good sizable audiences on the island of Vinylhaven. And this last year, for example, we did a children's concert during the day in the Waterman Center on North Haven, which attracted a lot of younger listeners. So we have not had the challenge that you might expect with contemporary music. I think, especially after 4th of July and right on through Labor Day, you have a really broad mix of constituencies, including year-rounders and summer visitors, that makes for solid audience participation.
That's marvelous. That's marvelous. Those are things that warm my heart to know that there's an audience. It's difficult, I think, to get people used to listening to things outside of the mainstream. The comment that I've made over and over and over again is that popular music tends to just dominate. And it's popular for a reason. People like it a lot, and it's easy to digest. It's like ice cream, you know.
Yeah.
Any child would rather have ice cream rather than
the
a
vegetables.
Pork chop, you know?
Well, we prepare our vegetables well, so they're tasty.
That's funny. So now that's that festival. Now you're getting performed in other places around the country and around the world, though, aren't you? I mean, that's got to be a challenge too for a composer. I mean, you got to get performed. I mean, that's.
I've been doing well. It was a lot easier for a variety of reasons. I went to Boston and became chair of music at Northeastern. And a lot of it was because Northeastern has a really interesting educational model in general, and that includes the arts. And I needed to be in the Boston area for family reasons as well. That was a wonderful opportunity, and I had a great time working through my 8-year contract as chair. But it's very difficult to keep an active career going when you're an administrator, especially at a place like Northeastern, which is so intense. Northeastern has a kind of disruptive educational model that requires everybody to be thinking and creating and collaborating with pedal to the metal, you know, 24/7 for 12 months of the year. And it was enormously gratifying for me, but it means that I've had to reconnect gradually with more and more of my previous collaborators and sort of get back into the swing of things as a composer. I had a really good professional background to base that on, and so I'm lucky. I mean, I've had a great time as a composer. It's been really rewarding. And, I'm looking forward to many years more as long as I can survive physically.
I can't speak for you. I know for me, that's a daily thing, I'm wondering.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Carl Reiner used to say that first thing he did in the morning, he'd open the paper and look in obituaries. And if his name wasn't in it, then he would have breakfast.
<That's right.
laughs> I think it's a pretty good philosophy, actually.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah.
So, well, you say you've got you're in the midst of writing a concerto now. Do you have a soloist already in mind? Are you writing for somebody specifically?
Well, the premiere's on March 15th in the Tsai Performance Center at Boston University. The soloist is the Grammy-winning Gloria Cheng, who is on the faculty at UCLA.
Wow.
And the orchestra is a new music-focused orchestra in Boston, the New England Philharmonic. The conductor, Chan Wei Nig, is a brilliant man and a great collaborator. And so I'm just pushing, I'm p- sorry, putting the finishing touches on the last movement. Gloria Cheng has already been working on the first two movements. And so I'm looking forward to the collaboration. Again, the premiere is on March 15th. So,
well, maybe we can touch base between now and then. I have a blog. I'll put in a little plug for myself here. I have a blog that is an extension of the podcast, and it allows me mm-hmm. to let people know what my guests are up to and when they're up to it, kind of thing. So I put in there different things. Comes out weekly, so we can talk more about that shortly.
Well, the New England Philharmonic is a great ensemble. I mean, I think that they do a wonderful they play a wonderful role in keeping recent orchestra music alive. And their composer in residence, Eric Nathan, who's also artistic director at Collage New Music Ensemble, he's an amazing new music citizen and a wonderful composer himself. And so that he's the advisor for the New England Philharmonic, and he's also written for some wonderful music for them. So did I say New England Philharmonic? So yeah, they're a terrific group, and I think people should get to know them more.
So when you are sitting down to write and you say, okay, I got an idea for something, does the idea include, you know, like the form and such, or do you just have a melody going and say, okay, what am I going to do with this? Or do you sit down and say, okay, or is it on a commission? I've got to write a concerto for the violin and orchestra. Or, how does that work? How's that process work?
Well, it's different with every composer,
sure.
But for me, it starts with a state of mind. And my state of mind was one of considerable anxiety around, you know, what is going on with the planet and with the country, and so the themes that sort of drive the, if you will, the mood that the music conveys are, I mean, the overall title is In a Time of Foreboding, and the last movement that I'm working on now is subtitled Chasing Freedom. And so it's very lively, but it has a slightly macabre or anxiety reflecting quality to it. At the same time, that it reflects a certain amount of hope about what may or may not be a path forward in the future. And you know, the second movement, for example, is called Lullaby Memorial for the Children of War. So those kinds of concerns kind of fueled the overall atmosphere of the piece. And then as I began to work with different ideas and work my way into the movement, what happens is that the structure of the movement begins to unfold in my mind. And at some point, you know, all the branches and the leaves kind of fill out. And then what often happens is that I have to go back and adjust everything or rearrange things or edit out and edit in certain things so that the result is a shape that makes sense to me and that I feel like I can share with listeners.
That makes sense. So, and one last thing I wanted to talk about real quick, like you wrote a book, Music Since 1945.
Right.
Is that a textbook or
It is a text. Yeah, it's a textbook. It's out of date now because it was published in the early to mid 90s with my late co-author Elliot Schwartz, and it is a textbook that's been used a lot. I was once giving a series of talks at different institutions in London. This was about 20 years ago, and everywhere I went, they said, "Oh, our teacher, our my advisor had me read this book in preparation for my comprehensive exams." So it's an attempt, at least up through about 95, to make music. Contemporary post-war developments in contemporary music apprehendable but understandable and clear to listeners that are sorry to readers that would include people like graduate students who know nothing about contemporary music or undergraduates who are taking a course on post-war music. And it would be difficult to follow up. I mean, I thought about new editions, the second edition. Elliot Schwartz and I were planning one until, unfortunately, he died of cancer and then about 10 years ago. The other thing that makes it difficult is that the boundaries and definitions and interactions between styles and between artists of various backgrounds have blended and overlapped so dramatically that even defining what constitutes American music, let alone contemporary music, would be very difficult to define in some really apprehensible way. And I'm not sure I'm up to the challenge, but also I think it's more important for me at this stage of my life to be writing my own music instead of writing about other people's music.
Well, I was wondering, World War II seemed to be a defining moment, the pre and post-war years for classical music and the post-war, yeah. And a lot of things have changed. I'm wondering if you think we're going to see a similar break in history pre and post-pandemic in the arts, and whether or not that had any kind of an effect, or you think will have any kind of an effect on compositional styles and the way we listen to music and just the way we absorb the arts in general.
Well, we're in a time of great uncertainty and upheaval.
Right.
And I felt this very much, you know, in terms of the kind of course content that I had to find a way to support after the George Floyd murder, for example. So that was more definitional than the pandemic in terms of course content and the kinds of music that people were writing and the concerns and in some ways it was very positive because it opened up people's ears to a lot of music that they weren't listening to because of racial bias. Now what's happening, of course, is there's been a big swing the other way because of the government that's in charge. There's a kind of anti-DEI bias, and in terms of support, you know, the Seal Bay Festival used to be supported by the National Endowment for the Arts. That was about a quarter of our budget. That's gone away. So the whole landscape has changed again. So there have been two upheavals, two swings in opposite directions. And the question will be, what happens when the pendulum comes back to the center, if it ever does? Because that'll be the next sort of post-era period that we can look to in terms of finding out where we land after all of this. All of these wild undulations that we're experiencing now.
Well, if we can hang in there long enough, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Maestro, thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with me today. I really, really, really appreciate it. And I could probably continue this conversation for another couple of hours, but I'm not going to do that to you.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking to you, and I really appreciate the questions and the time I appreciate the listening that you've talked about, and I hope you keep listening, and I hope...
Oh, absolutely. And we get a little closer to March, maybe we'll get you back on again. See.
I'd be delighted. Yeah.
Thank you so much. But in
thank
meantime,
you.
Thank you.
All
talk
right.
To you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, looking forward to it.
I'd like to thank Daniel for taking the time to come on the show. If you would like to know more about him or listen to his music, you can find a link to his website in the descriptions below. I'd like to thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you enjoy these podcasts, please share your favorite episodes with your friends and introduce them to Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.